Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Launch a Google News search about China, and you'll find dozens of articles about Chinese hackers targeting U.S. industries, government installations, and personal databases. You'll find articles about China's suppression of dissent, its attempts to control the internet. You'll find articles about piracy of U.S. video and music, about endemic political corruption, about continuing use of child labor, about belligerent military challenges to Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. You'll also find articles about China's enormous economic clout, its relentless creative entrepreneurs, and its emergence as a world financial power after decades as an economic basket case under Mao and his successors. Our guest in this hour of Midday, Evan Osnos, spent 8 years documenting the changes that China's 1.3 billion people experienced. He was a correspondent for The New Yorker and the Chicago Tribune before that. Although it's impossible to describe what's going on there in a few words, the title of Evan Osnos' new book, Age of Ambition, describes the ordinary and extraordinary people he found navigating the shift from socialist austerity, conformity, and idealism to unbridled and often ugly capitalist materialism, a society exuberantly confident but full of private doubt. China's relentless market economy has brought dazzling wealth to a few, a borderline level of middle-class comfort to the millions who have flooded China's cities, and nothing at all to millions of the poor and uneducated, largely in rural areas, who've been left behind. At the political and spiritual epicenter of this change is the battle between an authoritarian, corrupt, and outrageously privileged Communist Party and a growing internet-based culture of dissent, leaks, and rebellion. As Evan Osnos was China correspondent for The New Yorker from 2009 to 2013, and before that, as I said, with the Chicago Tribune, in a career that took him from the Metro desk to national correspondent to the Middle East, ultimately to China. At the Trib, he covered the 9/11 attacks and their aftermath. And in the Middle East, the Iraq War and events in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iran. In addition to his regular reporting for The New Yorker, Evan Osnos maintained a regular blog called Letter from China. His new book, a remarkable synthesis of ordinary people's lives and the events that he covered there, is entitled, as I say, Age of Ambition, with an important subtitle we'll go over with Evan, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. It's available from the publisher FSG. For Western readers, I would say this is a compelling personal glimpse into a China they've never known or are just getting to know. So, Evan Osnos, I want to thank you for joining us today on the Midday Show on WYPR in Baltimore and welcome you to our program.
Thank you very much, Dan. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an amazing story. You have to step back from it once in a while. I guess that's what you did here with the book. Step back and say, oh, my God, what happened here in the last 40 years, which is really an eye blink in Chinese history. And your book is not about statistics, but I want to rattle off a few here just to set this up a little bit, because I still find it kind of mind-spinning. 300 million Chinese have risen from absolute poverty since about 1980. 200 million have moved from farms to industry. 100 million have joined the middle class. 500,000 are now millionaires. And in the years since Tiananmen Square, China's per capita gross domestic product has grown from $403 a year to more than 7,000. And the country is 1.3 billion people now. That's about 19% of the world's human beings. But anyway, on the economic count, the economic and social mobility that we've seen in China in a short period of time is still pretty amazing, even for somebody like you who's been absorbed in this for so long.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that the statistics can sometimes boggle the mind. And I often found that I had to retreat into the most manageable kind of narrative, and that ultimately were the narratives of individual people. And you know, there's one statistic that is the kind of thing that you wouldn't see show up on top-line economic numbers, but in people's lives makes a big difference, which is that in the difference between 1976 and today for many people is as plain as the fact that they eat six times as much meat today, as much protein, as they did in 1976. And that gives you a feel for how transformative it has been inside the private lives of Chinese people.
You know, people say changes don't happen overnight, but in the great scheme of things, this one did. I mean, we're talking about, you mentioned 1976, so, 40 years ago or so. It's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, this is the hard thing to get your mind around. So Chinese history, of course, we've often been told is this great epic drama that unfolds over thousands of years, and it's all true. And you've got dynasties that will rise and fall over the course of centuries. And then in the blink of an eye, I mean, literally one generation, a generation and a half now, you've had the parameters of people's lives have been transformed, not just in the physical experience, in the sense that people are now growing up amid prosperity of a relative kind and peace of a relative kind for the first time in a very long time in Chinese history, but also what it means to be a person, just in terms of how you see yourself and your relationship to your neighbors, your relationship to the state, your relationship to your parents, to your job. All of those kinds of issues are in flux, and they're changing almost, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but if you go away from China for 6 months or a year and you come back, it's very often that you discover very visible changes in the lives of the people you've come to know.
Hmm. Evan, I'm still trying to get my mind wrapped around this hybrid economic model, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners still stopping here today to think about this as we talk during this hour. Unfettered capitalism and state control. some of us still don't get this, how this works out, and I know that's a big piece of this, but could you just give us a little bit of insight there?
Sure. I think that the defining fact about the Chinese political and economic system is that it's an improvisation. You know, from between 1949 and 1978-79, the first 30 years of the People's Republic, China was the most devoted, ardent believer in the economic principles of socialism. And it led the country to ruin, in effect. Chairman Mao's economic notions, which were based on collectivized agriculture, collectivized factories, they didn't in the end bring prosperity to people. And by the time Mao died, your average Chinese citizen had a lower per capita income than your average citizen of sub-Saharan Africa. China as a whole was poorer than North Korea in 1979. And what happened was that the leaders of the party, the heirs of Chairman Mao, looked around and realized that this was now a matter of political survival. If they wanted the Chinese Communist Party to survive, and ultimately, of course, for their own power to survive, they had to do something different. And what they did was that they, overnight almost, renounced economic policies of socialism. They gave up the scripture of socialism, and then they held on to the saints. Chairman Mao himself, his picture, of course, his portrait still hangs above Tiananmen Square. So what they did is they held on to the political organization of communism, but they threw open the doors to the free market, almost to a degree that those of us in the U.S. would find harrowing, and said, all right, all of you individual laborers are now to some degree responsible for yourselves, and you have to go out and figure out where you're going to work, where you're going to live, if you're able to accumulate any savings, how you're going to invest that money, if you're going to start a business. And that brought both this enormous economic dynamism, this energy that had been sort of pent up, latent energy for years and years and years. All of a sudden, there was this huge catch-up. But then it also leads us to today, where you have a feeling in China that the free market has almost run amok.
So if you were 55 or 60 years old in China, you might still be scratching your head because you were taught all this collectivist thinking. And then another generation comes along, and time passes, things change, and now you're supposed to what? Believe that you could be an agent of your own fate?
That's right, and it's a profound change because it even predated socialism. After all, if you go back in Chinese history, philosophically, you know, Confucian thought always privileged the group. You know, it was the family or the clan or the village that took precedence over the individual. And it, actually, if you look at Chinese art, I always find this a very vivid way to see this, that if you look at the classical Chinese paintings, almost always they are gorgeous landscapes in which the individual humans are these tiny little specks making their way through the mountains. And then you look at the equivalent paintings in the West, and the most, let's say the most famous classical Western painting would be the Mona Lisa, which after all was a full-frame portrait of an individual. So overnight, this philosophical foundation that had been rooted both in traditional thought and then in socialist thought was turned upside down, and people were told, all right, now you have to go out and define the limits of your own life.
Mm-hmm. And they believe that. So we talk about this post-Mao Chinese generation, post-Mao. This would be roughly equivalent to our Generation X, I guess. So they actually believe this, and they are thriving in it, at least some of them.
They are. It's been unsettling, of course. I mean, so the change in people's lives was so profound that in Chinese, the term they used is songbang, which is literally to untie a prisoner or an animal. And all of a sudden, people had been untied from these collective structures. And for some people, it was thrilling, after all, to be able to go out and decide, okay, now who is it that I'm going to marry? And, you know, that created a whole new market for the kinds of institutions that we have in the West that allow people to take their own private desires and make them real. So, for instance, dating services. Instead of having a traditional matchmaker or a local village cadre who would line up two young people with minimal participation from the bride and groom, all of a sudden you had young Chinese men and women who were saying, all right, I'm going to pay $50 to sign up for a dating service, and then I'm going to choose who it is that I want to settle down with. But then, of course, and this is where it gets interesting, they run up against the outer limits of that autonomy when it gets to their political lives. And that creates an enormous sense of tension because you've got this sudden autonomy over things as basic as what you buy and, you know, the food you eat and the places you travel and the people you date. But when it comes to figuring out who's going to rule the country in your name, well, that remains out of reach.
Out of reach. And therefore, is it even a question?
That's a good question, because I think for a lot of people of their parents' generation, it was never a question.
Right.
You know, you left the ship of state in the hands of those who were capable of doing so. There was a great line, Sun Yat-sen, you know, the father of modern China in many ways, used to compare government to the newest invention of his day, which was the automobile. And he said, you know, you would never imagine driving an automobile yourself. You would leave it to a trained professional, a chauffeur. And in some ways, that was the governing philosophy for many years that followed. But for the young crowd today, the people who have been born amid this period of unusual openness, well, they do consider the idea of having a greater degree of political control. I think what's interesting, Dan, is they don't use the word democracy because it's sort of been poisoned and been politicized. But they talk about things like the importance of justice and the importance of rule of law. And all of these kinds of values have become proxies for a political conversation that they can't have explicitly.
We're going to take a break here, Evan, and come back and talk some more. Evan Osnos, our guest, is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He served as The New Yorker's China correspondent from 2008 to 2013. And now a book reflecting on his time there and in China today, Age of Ambition, it's called, Chasing Fortune, Truth and Faith in the New China. That faith part is particularly interesting. We'll get to it in this hour of midday on WYPR. I want to tell our listeners how to get in touch with us if you have a question about the New China for Evan Osnos. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance. Our number is 866-661-9309. Or you can address a question, a comment for Evan Osnos by email, midday@wypr.org. Age of Ambition, the title of Evan Osnos' book, is particularly apt because it refers to the ambition of individual Chinese to make it in China's version of America's so-called Gilded Age of unfettered capitalism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Evan Osnos chronicling this for The New Yorker, and now his observations, his reporting, and stories about these people in his book, Age of Ambition. You mentioned dating service a little while ago in China, and one of the interesting stories in the book that fascinated me was a woman who started an internet dating service, because it also says a lot about Chinese society today. And I thought I'd ask you about her first.
Her name is Gong Hainan, and she grew up in a little village at the base of a mountain. And her parents, of course, had grown up in a period of enormous deprivation and very limited mobility. They never imagined leaving the village. They couldn't read or write. But she was born right at the beginning of this enormous economic experiment, and she was growing up to believe that she had greater control. So from, I should say that, you know, from some of this is just the quirk of her own chemistry. She was born with this entrepreneurial instinct, and from the time she was a little kid, she thought, well, you know, if I buy popsicles in the village square and bring them out to our little town and sell them, I can mark them up. And so from the time she was a little kid, she started charting this path around the neighborhood, and she figured out which families would give in to their kids squealing and who she could actually sell popsicles to. And then as she got older, she went to school. She had the opportunity to get an education in Beijing. And her life was so different than the life of her parents. She, after all, had a graduate degree. She had this great education. She was living in the city, that they really couldn't help her find anybody to settle down with. And so she looked around and said, you know, I need to find somebody for myself. And so she actually paid money to a dating service. They sent her a list of names. She got in touch with them. And she discovered that actually she'd been tricked. This was a scam. Basically, these weren't real people. They were fake dates, really. They were, you know, composites. And so she said, well, I'm going to start a dating company for people like me. And she did. And it turned out there was an enormous market for it. People, hundreds of millions of people across China were getting up from their villages just like she had and moving to the cities and finding themselves totally alone and adrift and desperate to find somebody to settle down with. And so even before the internet was fully adopted in China, she started the equivalent of Match.com, and people would mail in their photos and their biographies to have them posted on the site. And it was actually so successful that in the time that I knew her, she went from living in a little apartment, a little studio apartment, to taking her company public on the New York Stock Exchange. She made $77 million.
And
I went to visit her out at her new house in the suburbs.
How old is she? Yeah. How old would you say she is?
You know, she's my age, basically. We were born about the same year. She's about 37.
Okay.
Amazing. And I just found, you know, the thing about her story, and this is the, you know, in some ways, Dan, you know this as a journalist, we all face this struggle about, do we pick somebody whose life is typical or do we pick somebody whose life is atypical when we write? And her life is totally atypical in some obvious ways. Look, she's a millionaire. But at the same time, the dynamics that drove her and the dynamics that shape her life, I think, are broadly reflective of things happening in China and are worth telling.
Well, I'm curious about economic and social mobility, actual physical mobility from rural areas into the cities. So that is happening, but on what kind of scale?
On a huge scale. It's, you know, the numbers are that there are somewhere around 200 million migrants who move from the countryside to the city. But I think it's worth pointing out that when they get there, it's a difficult process because they don't automatically get full access to public services like education and healthcare. And that's a real issue in China because when you're born, you are given a registration either as urban or rural. And it's very hard to change that if you're a rural registrant. And so one of the big political issues that I think we'll expect to see perhaps changing over the course of the next few years is making it easier for people who move from the countryside into the city to be able to get full access. Otherwise, they'll end up with slums on the edges of the cities that they're trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting point of tension, right? Maybe not a big one, but it's something where the new generation may insist on and the government may have to soften, change its policies.
You're absolutely right. This is one of those interesting demonstrations of the struggle over control, because historically the Chinese government wanted to maintain control over where people lived because they believed if they didn't have enough people in the countryside farming, then they would never be able to feed the cities. And that principle, which made sense in the perhaps in the 1950s, makes less sense today. Farming's more efficient. You have people who are desperate to get to the cities, and ultimately the government needs to figure out a way to allow that to happen. And it's also about giving people control over their own lives. And you know, this for me is in many ways the crux of the problem that the government faces, which is that it is organized around notions of who can control things. And people who are growing up today have gained control over so much else in their lives that they do find it hard when they are told that they can't have control over something as basic as where they can live.
Let's talk about control of information in the media, because I've been curious to ask you this question about your own experiences in China, but also just generally, how do people get information today? First, start with your own experience there. I wonder, when you went about your business writing pieces for The New Yorker, interviewing people, moving around the country, or Beijing, were there any restrictions placed on your movements, who you could speak with, what you could write about?
There are restrictions. As a foreign journalist, we're treated somewhat, we're considered a bit radioactive. I think you know, the government over the years has generally relaxed the restrictions so that we can go most places in the country, with the exception, it's a big exception, of Tibet. And also parts of Xinjiang, which is the predominantly Muslim region in the northwest of the country. And but up until a few years ago, you really couldn't travel even that widely. And so there has been an improvement in that on that basis. But one thing you do find is that when you go into a little village, you can't be there very long before the local police or the local party committee takes note of your presence and comes asking why you're there. And in many cases, they will ask you to leave. So over the years that I was there, you learn to avoid those kinds of confrontations. And part of that is because inevitably the consequences are always harshest for the Chinese sources who are helping you. And so in the beginning, there's a certain, let's be honest, there's a certain glamour in getting into a scrap with police in a village. And it took me a while to realize, wait a second, that's the wrong way to go about this. And so I became more sophisticated, I hope, about for instance, getting people to leave the village, meet me in a larger city so that we can have an interview there where we just are harder to detect. And then the other piece of this, of course, is digital surveillance. And I received a notice from Google after I'd been there for a few years saying, we have reason to believe that you're email account, your Gmail account, has been compromised by state-sponsored hackers. And a lot of us got that warning. And I think it was I basically came to believe that everything I wrote and put online was compromised, and therefore I never put names of sensitive sources onto the computer because that would put them at risk.
What about in society generally today in China and the flow of information, the news gathering and the dissemination of news? Just a little bit on that, because I'm leading up to a question about the Arab Spring I want to ask you about.
Yeah, that's been an amazing change over the course of the time that I've been involved with China over the last 15 years, is that there has been this surge of interest among the public about information, and then also the opportunity to gather it. I mean, look, just as on a technical level, all of the newspapers in China, for instance, are owned in some form or another by the state. But as people got richer, as the economy got more complex and sophisticated, they did realize that they had to open up some space for semi-independent publications. And as they did that, it created, it had a sort of feedback effect where now that there were starting to be these better magazines and newspapers, some of these more vigorous investigative instincts, well, then people came to expect it. They demanded it, and that created a market for it. And so then you got more and more. And then into the mix, of course, there was the internet. And the internet turned everybody online into, if they wanted to be, an investigative reporter. And so people would go out and they would take video or they would report in their village on what was happening. And that created this cat and mouse game, which is now such an essential part of information culture in China, which is that people put things online and then it's up to the government to race around and try to remove the things that will be embarrassing or harmful to the government's image. And the contours of that battle over information about truth is constantly shifting. And there are moments when the government has restricted what people can do, and then there are moments when they open up. This happens to be a moment right now when the space for information exchange and for news gathering in China is very limited, more limited than it has been in years.
Hmm. Well, let me get to my question about Arab Spring, because you were in China during that time. And I wonder, how did that play there in the news? Were people made aware of it? Did the government issue any statement about what was happening in the Middle East in terms of a demand for changes in society, political changes, possibly even democracy?
Yeah, this was a source of enormous uneasiness for the government. After all, the news that there were people filling public squares in places like Cairo and Tunisia demanding regime change was very unsettling for the state. China, 25 years after Tiananmen Square, is acutely sensitive to the possibility of public political action. And so their solution from an information perspective was to pretend it didn't exist. And they sent out the Central Propaganda Department, which is the government agency that oversees all of the news organizations and in fact, the universities and anywhere else that information is valued and exchanged. They sent out orders that were very clear. They said, you're not to report on the Arab Spring beyond what the government's official reports say, and those would be very limited. And they actually went into detail saying, for instance, don't put any photographs of Chinese leaders next to photographs of the events in Cairo, in Tahrir Square. Don't do anything that would suggest any kind of association between these two places. And at the same time that was happening, of course, people were going online and reading about what was happening, particularly young people who are more adept at getting around some of the censors and the filters. And so what you had was this odd scenario where people were picking up the newspaper in the morning, the People's Daily, and being told that everything in the world was tranquil and business as usual. But then they would go online and discover that something fundamental was changing about the nature of authoritarianism and about the possibility of challenging it. And that created a disconnect in people's minds.
Hmm. Evan, as you go about speaking to different people then about how they live today in the new China, say someone who owns a small business or an entrepreneur, someone who's with a startup or someone who's employed by a startup, any of the people you speak with, do they have political ambitions, political ideas, or are they mostly focused on making money?
I think they're mostly focused on making money, on educating their children, on maintaining what small gains they've probably accumulated over the course of the last generation. And they don't, they have learned very explicitly the dangers of political activism or political action. It's not hard to see. And everybody has some story of somebody they went to school with who said the wrong thing one day, published an article that was critical of the wrong person, then found themselves in trouble. So oftentimes those people who do put themselves out front as a dissident or a political activist, and I spent a lot of time with folks like that and write about them in the book, these are not people who are doing this blindly. They know that they're taking enormous risks. But I would say that one of the interesting things is that those people we talked about a moment ago who are living basically private lives, trying to avoid running into the harsher edges of the state, oftentimes when they do become politicized, it's not by their own choice. It's because of the action. It's because of the circumstances of their lives. So if you're that entrepreneur, for instance, and one day you wake up and discover that the brother of the local party secretary has opened a business that has more or less stolen your intellectual property or is doing something replicating it, or let's say they use their political connections to gain control of a piece of land that you needed for your own business, all of a sudden, you've become politicized, even though you never wanted to be, because right. You realize that your own gains, your own property is at risk.
Can we talk about the faith part of the subtitle of your book, Age of Ambition, Evan Osnos? You seem to think that there's something missing here. I guess I was trying to get at it with my question about whether folks are in China focused on making money, or do they have, have they developed political ideology and a real sense of individuality? Do you mean? What's the faith part of this? What's missing?
Yeah, that's the really interesting part of the story in China, and it's one that we don't often read about. You know, it doesn't make it onto the business pages of the newspaper.
Right.
But when you spend a long time there, what you discover is that as people began to satisfy the most basic needs that they had, you know, to be able to make some money for the first time in their lives, and then gradually they began to acquire some information about the world around them. Maybe they traveled. They began to read websites from overseas. But what they discovered was that China's economic transformation has not answered the existential questions in their lives. And I think it's vital to understand how important that is. If you sit at a Chinese dinner table these days with friends, oftentimes the conversation will eventually turn to something about morality or values or spirituality, because remember, you know, it's easy for us to imagine that socialism was this world in which there was no faith, there was no spiritual life. But actually, strangely enough, life under Chairman Mao was a hugely spiritual experience. You would almost, in many cases, people would literally confess their sins at the foot of his statues, and they would hold up Mao's little red book, and they would read the text. So it was a religious experience for people. And then overnight, that disappeared. And the entire value system that was associated with socialism, which was this an absolutist way of life, disappeared, and there was this void now at the center of Chinese life, which the Chinese call the spiritual void, the jingsheng kongxu. It's a hole, and in many ways, it's up to individuals to fill it. And so you've got there's this huge spiritual ferment going on. And China today now has more Christians, for instance, than there are members of the Communist Party, and there are people who are pursuing Chinese Buddhism, Taoism. The Baha'i faith. In Beijing, my wife and I lived right next door to one of the old Confucius temples. And I would watch people go from the Tibetan temple across the street, and they would pray there. Then they would come over to the Confucius temple, they'd pray there. And then they might stop at a Catholic church on the way home just to be safe.
So they're sampling them all, looking for their mooring, spiritual mooring maybe.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I think there is a sense of experimentation going on, because the government has in many ways recused itself from this spiritual conversation. The Communist Party today, after all, has no religious identification. And so it has allowed people, and allowed is the wrong word, it has had no choice but to watch as people have begun to try to answer some of the big questions for themselves. Questions like, what am I here for? You know, what's my role as a citizen? What's my role as a father or a son or a sibling? You know, what are my responsibilities, for instance, to my neighbor? And then in business terms, this is interesting, because people will say, you know, what are my ethical obligations to produce a safe product? A few years ago, you remember there was a terrible case in which dairy farmers and distributors added chemicals to milk.
Oh, yeah.
In order to boost the protein content, to mm-hmm. boost the readings of protein content. Mm-hmm. It ended up sickening 300,000 kids. Six babies died in the course of this. And it sparked a national conversation, not just about food safety and inspections, but really about morality and what it was that China would stand for as it plunged ahead in this great improvisation.
We're going to take another break here and come back and speak some more with Evan Osnos. His book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. If you have a question about the new China today, for Evan Osnos, this is a great time to give us a call. Here's how you reach us at midday, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. And the midday email address, I have a couple of emails to read. You can send a question that way, midday@wypr.org. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest this hour, Evan Osnos, correspondent for The New Yorker, was in China for several years. A book about China now, The New China, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. FSG is the is the publisher. And to follow up on what we were just talking about, Evan, in the business world and some of the problems that have occurred in terms of, I guess you call it, quality control. You mentioned the problem with milk a few years ago. There's been defective Chinese drywall ending up in American homes. We've had problems with toys, pharmaceuticals, paint, dog food, I think, and also. Mm-hmm. And now, more recently, a problem with expired meat. And one of our listeners, Vince, wonders, is this business as usual in certain segments of Chinese culture or business? Is it really changing? Is there really a debate about the ethics of all this? And if so, why do incidents like this persist despite progress in other areas?
It's a great question, and it's, I can tell you, it's one of the things that Chinese people talk about all the time, because it has this very, obviously very vivid impact on their lives. If you can't go into a store and be confident of the products on the shelves, then it gives you an insecure feeling about your whole life. And if you talk to people in China today and you ask them, what do you want? Fundamentally, what do you want more than anything else? Oftentimes the answer is consistent. And what they say is, I want security, a feeling of security. And that can be surprising in a country that is, after all, at peace, after all these years of political turmoil in the past. But what they mean is they want to know that what they have, the little nest egg they've accumulated, is safe. And part of that means safe food and safe products. I think there's a couple of explanations for why this keeps happening. One of them reminds me of a moment in American history, which is, as I write in the book, you know, that China today reminds me very much of the Gilded Age in America, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, when you had this huge economic energy. And you did not yet have a political system and a regulatory system that was remotely capable of controlling it or addressing it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in the United States, we had huge corruption. We had unsafe products being sold in stores. We had unsafe food. Ultimately, that led to the creation of the Food and Drug Administration. And we've seen something similar in China, too, which is that you've got these new entrepreneurs or in some cases, existing entrepreneurs. But they look around and they realize nobody is minding what I do very closely. And I'm in a very competitive space. I've got if I don't do something, then my neighbor will do it. The identical company across the street will do it. And so I've got to do whatever I can to survive. And I think, you know, in Chinese, people say that they don't call it a dog-eat-dog world. They call it a man-eat-man world out there these days. And that feels to many people the way it is. I think it's hugely competitive. And without a fully articulated sense of public morality, and certainly the Communist Party is not in a position to be giving people a kind of sense of moral leadership, then it's up to them to do it themselves. And as a result, you get these abuses.
Evan Osnos, our guest from The New Yorker. Let's take a couple of calls, speak with our listeners. Bob in Baltimore with your question for Evan. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, Mark. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Dan. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by this particular discussion. But Evan, what year did you first go to China?
I went for the first time in 1996 as a student.
I guess I'm just utterly fascinated by your take on this, because I was there in 1981, within about a year of the opening, and
yeah,
we were constantly, because we had communist minders, we were subject to the search, we had no locks on our hotel rooms, that sort of thing. But but even then, I can guarantee you that I am convinced to this day that the very heart of the Chinese economic revolution was based on the fact that it was bottoms up. Because from
Absolutely.
The day I walked into my first open-air market in a village, a small village outside Guangzhou, we saw the incredible entrepreneurial ability as well as spirit that was inherent in the Chinese people. And even at that time, they were very reluctant to talk to us, of course, but I can remember one man saying something about, this is a lot different. I asked him, this is quite different from Mao Zedong's time, isn't it? Because Deng Xiaoping was the Chinese premier at the time. And he looked at me and just gave me a stare, and then he turned around and spat. onto the ground.
It sounds like Bob, when Bob was there, Evan, he sensed that energy that you talk about, and that human energy, that ambition in that you talk about in the book a lot.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say, I think that Bob makes it, he picked up on a very interesting and often overlooked point, which is that when we talk about China's economic transformation, very often what we say is that Deng Xiaoping opened China to the world and stirred the free market and so on and so on. And actually, when you look at the history and you look at the details there, the truth is something quite different, which is that it began, truly began, as a local insurgency of a certain kind. The story is short and great, which is that in the winter of 1978-79, in a little village in Anhui province, the farmers were so desperate, they were so poor after all these years of failed collectivized farming, that they had turned to begging, and they said, we can't do this any longer. And they made a pact among themselves that if any of them got arrested for what they were about to do, that they would take care of each other's families. And then they ripped up the collectives. They tore them apart and they said, we are now going to farm for ourselves on our own schedules, on our own time. And the local officials looked at this and said, this is seditious, this is heresy. But actually in Beijing, wiser heads prevailed and they said, hold on, let this go for a minute. Let's see how this goes. And it worked, and it was replicated for 800 million peasants across the country. And so in many ways,
wow,
you know, that bottom-up force is essential to understanding why China has become what it is today.
Another question for Evan Osnos. This is Courtney in Baltimore. You're on Midday. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for doing this show. I lived in China from 2000 to 2002, and I really enjoy hearing about what China is like now. That starts really my question, which is, when I was there, there was definitely sort of signs of capitalism, in the sense that, like, you know, there was stuff for sale everywhere all the time. But when I talked to people and I got to know a lot of Chinese people, there really wasn't any kind of, interest, in talking about capitalism or morality or religion or any of the things that Evan is talking about with this book. And I'm wondering, like, how did this dialogue sort of become a part of the discourse of regular people?
You know, I think part of it is, well, there's a few ways to look at it, I suppose. I mean, one of the joys of being a journalist is that you are able, almost expected, required to ask uncomfortable questions and to keep pushing and nudging and nudging. And, you know, I knew people over this long period of time. So I was there for 8 years, from 2005 to 2013. And in the beginning, people didn't want to talk about a lot of things. And it would take a long time before people became more comfortable. But I don't actually think it has much to do with me. I think it really is about the sense that in the beginning, people were so focused on just, you know, the period that the caller describes, 2000 to 2002, you know, many people were still in the midst of just trying to get their feet planted, starting a new business or getting something ahead, getting ahead of where they had been before, that these abstract notions of values and systems just seemed irrelevant. And, you know, we've all, I think those of us who've been in China, you've been in the experience where you try to bring up some high-minded notion about the difference between the Chinese political system or the Western political system, and you get this kind of dismissive wave of the hand, which means A, I don't really want to talk about it, but B, I don't have time to talk about it. I'm too busy just trying to get things done, and right. I think that may explain some of it.
Hey, Evan, I wanted to ask you about some of the figures in the book and in the time that remains here. I had a question about the inveterate gambler Ping. And about gambling, you note in the book that while Chinese will describe themselves as being more cautious than Americans, generally, that they actually are gamblers. They gamble more with their investments, take riskier investments than Americans generally, people of comparable wealth in the U.S. Is that true?
Yeah, there's been some interesting social science research, some laboratory experiments where they ask people to make choices, for instance, in fictional transactions. And one thing that comes through, and this became very helpful to me in understanding why people would make these choices, for instance, to get themselves up from a village and move across the country with no expectation of a job, nobody to rely on, was that actually fundamentally in people's worldview, they were more comfortable taking risks. So the experiment that I'm describing, which was done by a couple of social scientists at the University of Chicago asked people to compared the way that Westerners and Chinese people will, it was Americans specifically, Americans and Chinese people, how they would, how comfortable they were taking risks in a financial transaction. And what they discovered was that both the Americans and the Chinese believed at the beginning of the experiment that the Americans would be the risk takers, because that's part of our image. Mm-hmm. But what they discovered, in fact, was that the Chinese people were taking larger risks consistently across the board in the experiment. And there's two explanations. One is what's known as the cushion hypothesis, which is that you have a big family in China, and therefore, traditionally, I mean, and therefore, if something goes wrong, then you have all these people you could turn to for help to bail you out. And that's been part of the Confucian ethic, is that you help your relatives. And then the other piece of it is a very modern thing, which is that people have been raised over the last generation to take huge risks, or they'll be left behind.
Does that translate into the Chinese infatuation with gambling and the person, inveterate gambler Ping, you describe in the book, who won a fortune in Macau?
Yeah, I think it does. I got interested in Macau, which is, after all, now the world's largest gambling city. It has revenue on the order of about five or six times the revenue of Las Vegas every year. And I wanted to know why. Why was this place simply so successful? And also, what did it tell us about the Chinese people? And I think what came through is that, you know, historically, Chinese have gambled for centuries. That's been a part of life. And it's, you know, it's just one of the ways that you pass the time at a family gathering. But I think in the modern age, it has also become, I saw it really as a metaphor for everything in China, which was that people were constantly doing these things that I would find to be unbearably risky if they were in my own life. But people were willing to do it. In the case of inveterate gambler Peng, you'll remember he was a barber living in a little town in Hong Kong, and he decided to try to beat the mob and beat the house in the casino. And without giving away the end of the story, it was a hell of a ride.
Evan, we only have about a minute or so left here. I wish we had another hour. but you're not completely optimistic about China's future, are you?
In the short term, I have a lot of concerns about the place. I think they just have a lot of there's a lot of political tension that is building up around some of the issues we've talked about today, about political control and autonomy, and also about the fair distribution of the country's gains. They have moved into the hands of a small group of people, and that ultimately will have to be sorted out. And I'm afraid that it will be a long and difficult process. But over the long term, I have to say the thing that gives me the greatest source of optimism is that energy that I think so many of us have seen when we go to China, just this sheer determination to improve one's way of life. And for many of us in America, that actually sounds, it looks and feels familiar.
Mm-hmm. And the government, not completely repressive? You would use the word repressive?
It is repressive today. It is, particularly on political affairs. But in the cone of control that people have gained over their private lives is constantly slowly expanding. And there will be moments where it shrinks again and the government pushes. But I think over the long term, you can't force people back into the way of life that they had for so long. They simply won't accept it.
Evan Osnos, staff writer at The New Yorker, who served as the China correspondent for the magazine from 2008 to 2013, award-winning journalist. His book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Excellent reading, excellent job, excellent interview. Thank you for this conversation, Evan.
Thanks very much, Dan. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning into our first hour of Midday today. We're going to take a break now for lunch and the news from NPR. Lunch provided today by Breathe Bookstore Cafe. Breathe Bookstore Cafe serves vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free savories and sweets, coffee, tea, juices, and more. Breathe Bookstore Cafe is open 7 days a week, and it's over on the Avenue in Hamden. Stay tuned for the news from NPR, and then the second hour of Midday.